My name is Mark Brazidis, and I'm the director of the Creative Writing Program. And on behalf of the Department of English and our chair, Jim Harms, our associate chair, Tim Sweet, our director for the Center for Writing Excellence, and a woman who was working on Election Day, Laura Brady. On behalf of my colleagues in creative writing, I was working too, so. Jim Harms, Kevin Oderman, Ethel Morgan Smith, there's a familiar name. Alyssa High, Marianne Salmon, and Glenn Taylor, welcome and thank you for coming tonight. Although Ethel Morgan Smith's latest book, The Entertaining and Revealing Reflections of the Other Being Black in Germany, is mostly concerned with what the title suggests, it also touches on a subject closer to home, specifically her home and ours, Morgantown, West Virginia. Ethel relates with considerable restraint, given the circumstances, the fanatical attempt by one of her neighbors to chop down her catalpa, is that how you pronounce it? Catalpa tree. He was annoyed because some of the tree's leaves had fallen on his lawn. The impotence of nature. She also lets us know about the Department of English faculty member, since retired, I think, who would only say hello to people who were wearing purple. Professor Plum, one might have called her. What touched me especially was Ethel's wry summation of Morgantown's weather. It was familiar because 13 years ago, Ethel had given me the same information about the worse-than-Seattle rainfall, about the days and days of gray skies. Of course, she'd provided me with this information only after I'd signed on to teach here. Don't tell your wife, she said. I didn't, but I think she's figured it out by now. Ethel's memoir is, of course, more than this, much more than this. It's a compelling look at German culture from the perspective of an African-American woman. She weaves anecdotes of her time in Germany into a larger portrait of the country with revelations large and small. I was amused to learn that some Germans schedule their sex lives so as to avoid having children on Hitler's birthday. I shouldn't fail to mention Ethel's many accomplishments. In addition to her latest book, she is the author of From Whence Cometh My Help, The African American Community at Hollins College. Her essay, Love Means Nothing, was the winner of the 2005 Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation Award. She has published in national and international journals, including Kalalu and African American Review. Woody Allen said that in his next life, he'd like to be reincarnated as Warren Beatty's hands. I think it would be pretty neat to come back to life as Ethel's passport. She is the recipient of the Rockefeller Foundation Fellowship in Bellagio, Italy, a Fulbright Fellowship to Germany, a Visiting Artist American Academy in Rome Fellowship, a DuPont Fellowship, and a Brandeis University Women's Research Center Visiting Fellowship. One final note on Ethel's latest book. In addition to its many other merits, it is a tale, a cautionary tale, perhaps, both funny and bitter, of cross-cultural romance. Reader, beware. No, dive in. Please welcome Ethel Morgan Smith.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. I will read no romance tonight. You have to buy the book for the romance story, okay? But good evening, and happy after Election Day. I thank you all for coming. My students, whom I always learn a lot about teaching and writing from, I'm very appreciative of you. To my colleagues and my friends, and welcome. I'm going to do a couple of things before I get involved with the book. First, I happened to think of this today. This is a poem that Phyllis Wheatley was an 8-year-old slave girl, and she wrote to George Washington, and he wrote her a letter back in February 1776. And here's a little bit of that poem. One century sacred performed its destined round, when Galax powers Columbia furrier found, and so may you, whoever dares disgrace the land of freedom's heaven, defeated race. Proceed, great chief, with virtue on the side. Try every action. Let the goddess guide a crown, a mansion, and a throne that shine with golden, unfading Washington be thine. So I thought that was very appropriate. This little 8-year-old slave girl couldn't imagine what we experience last night and in year 2008. So I thought I would try to honor her tonight. Another person I'd like to honor is my friend Opal Moore. Opal Moore is a poet, and she teaches at Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia, and she just lost her mother. I use an epigraph of one of Opal's poems in chapter 5 of the book, and I'll read that to you. This chapter is called Marching into the New Millennium. I was in Germany as everybody was getting ready for the late 90s, and everybody was talking about year 2000. In my dreams of rose, each turn glitters. The road remembers your footsteps. Each night is crossroad, and I must choose a Babylon burning and be cursed or reason. Mother, this choosing is hard. So may her mother have a safe crossing over, and may the ancestors be reaching out for her with both hands. Thank you. I'm finding my way through this book in terms as a reading kind of text, which is different than a writing kind of text. So I hope it's interesting to you. If it's not, I have another reading, and you can come to that one. So, okay. Tübingen is such a golden place. It invites everyone to dream of staying. But as far as the Germans are concerned, you come and you leave. That was the deal, and all is well with the world. I learned quickly that life in Germany is very serious. Germans are serious about everything. Bernd Engler had told me that even humor is no laughing matter, and if you wanted to tell a joke, you may have to submit a written application first. I always thought he was joking. Serendipity is not a word in the lexicon of Germans. They disapprove of the irrelevant, the flippant, and the accidental. It's hardly conceivable and not desirable that a good idea might come about by chance or from someone lacking the proper qualifications. It seemed to me that Germans would prefer to forego a clever invention rather than admit that creativity is a random and chaotic process. The marketplace is the entry to the old city and a reception area, a location for all kinds of events, and it's a leaving point. But for me, it was a place of daydreaming and night dreaming. The home of markets, every kind of place to exchange old and new, the marketplace in Tübingen. When I shopped at the outdoor market, walking around, tasting food that was foreign to my tongue, I felt European. The Greek women with the Greek flower ladies wore black printed headscarves and long black dresses with lots of gold and silver jewelry were my favorites. During the chilly early fall weather, a fire would blaze and music hung in the crisp air. Often the music was familiar to me, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles singing I Second That Emotion or The Piano Man by Billy Joel. Sometimes I didn't recognize the tune, but I always felt it. My host professor had telephoned me early one Friday morning, 6 months before I was to arrive. It was 8 o'clock in the morning for me and 2 p.m. for him. Hello, this is Bernd Engler, the person you'll be working with in Germany. Oh, good morning. Hoping I didn't sound as sleepy as I was. Did I wake you? No, not at all. You see, I live alone, and you're the first person I've spoken to. That's why I sound so sleepy. He laughed. At least he had a sense of humor. All I had ever heard about Germans were they were orderly and arrogant. I'm calling to introduce myself and to say welcome. I also wanted to see what your needs are regarding housing. I'm looking forward to being there. Thank you. He didn't sound German. His accent was slight only, more international. What did Germans sound like? After this call, we can communicate via email. That would be fine. Your needs, he said. I need a bathtub. Anything else? Sure. But that's a main need. What about a kitchen? I figured there would be a kitchen. He laughed again. Did I have a better sense of humor than I thought? I didn't think asking for a bathtub was that big of a deal, at least not laughable. More than half of my German students had studied or spent periods of time in the States. As a result, they spoke good English. And there was the handful who believed that the Queen's English still reigned. They were well-read and sophisticated, but lacked some of the nuances in African-American literature. For an example, because of anthologies, Alice Walker's Everyday Use is one of the most popular short stories taught in German high schools and universities. In the short story, Walker alludes to the quilting as a basis for high art. Further, during the 1960s, Alice Walker criticized the tendency among African Americans to give up the names their parents gave them, names which embodied the history of their recent past, for African and Muslim names that did not relate to a single person they knew. Hence, the mother character in everyday use is amazed that her daughter Dee, who would give up her name, was the name of her great-grandmother, a woman who had kept her family together against great odds. Her new name had no relationship to a person she knew or to the personal history that had sustained her family. Because of that short story, Germans assumed that changing one's name was an African-American tradition. I wanted to expand their concept and point out a different story for them. Changing one's name is just as American as jazz. I use Cher, Cary Grant, Bob Dylan, and Marilyn Monroe to make my point. I talked about how immigrants had come to America and changed their names in order to become more American. Sometimes customs agents misspelled names of individuals, and those names were often kept. But Alice Walker's short story offered me an opportunity to help open up a discussion as to why African Americans had changed their names and still do. This discussion led the class into the institution of slavery. Later that week, I walked to the Rye House, which is their city hall, to learn about the conditions under which Germans changed their names. I was told that changing one's name was not encouraged. In fact, Germans offered a list of names to future parents. To change your name, you had to pay a fee of 1,500 Deutschmarks, and you had to write an essay for about 1,000 words expressing why name change was necessary. Afterwards, the request had to be approved by a committee. No wonder Germans didn't change their names. It was too complicated. In my slave narrative traditions class, we were discussing Toni Morrison's Tar Baby, one of my favorite novels to teach. It's a cold text. It has no personal emotional involvement for me. Gloria Naylor's Linden Hills works the same way. I was surprised at how my female students liked the character's son, who is supposed to be the predator in the text. He is described as a ragged, starving African-American man who breaks into the house. And this is how Jay Dean, an African-American woman, describes him. He's the kind of black man she had dreaded since childhood, uneducated, violent, and held contempt of her privilege. But my female students were salivating over son. "You understand he's the bad guy?" I asked. "Yes," said one female student. The others laughed. The male students were quiet for once. "But he sounds so delicious," another student said. "Professor Smith, we don't understand America's racism." "Racism doesn't just belong to America. You have yours, too. Racism is as old as the world." "Why should it matter if a person of a different race marries a person of another race?" another student asked. "Have you ever dated from another race? If so, how did your parents feel when you brought him home for dinner?" The room was silent for a long time. "Professor Smith, race is an 18th, 19th century conscript, a student pointed out. "I was expanding the definition to include practice." "I see," the student answered, but looking like he didn't believe me. I didn't care. Well, racism has the same impact everywhere, oppression for all, even the oppressor, I said. "He was just trying to explain our ideas," another student chimed in. "So, if I tell you that I hate white Americans, especially of those of the American South because of slavery, that's enough of a reason to be racist?" "No, but it explains it." The only explanation for racism is that it's wrong, and no one has a right to it. "That's in theory, but life is more complicated than that," said another student. "You say to me, I, an heir of slavery, I am not going to let you get away with this. If anything, you people started a lot of this. Ask yourself, what was Hitler's goals?" It was the first time I had mentioned Hitler in Germany. "And while you're at it," I continued, "ask yourself, how do you treat the nations like how do you treat others like the Turks, the Greeks, and the Italians who've been here for generations, but they can only be real citizens via blood? That's different, the same student said. We did them a favor by inviting them over here to work. Well, the Turkish taxi driver who picks me up at the train station when I take the last train from wherever thinks that he has paid and repaid that debt. Is that what you would have said to Stamp Paid in Toni Morrison's Beloved? I was more concerned about my female students, who seemed less enthusiastic about their future. They appeared to want to get on with marriage, babies, keeping a spotless house, cooking heavy meals, and then looking forward to caring for an elderly parent or grandparent. The most imagination they showed in their careers was being teachers. It paid well with lots of holidays, but most important, it was a very secure job. I couldn't get any more information from them regarding what they really wanted. I really didn't feel like an American or a female or an African American. I felt like a teacher trying to get the best out of my students, and they were fighting me all the way. I had accepted an invitation to speak at a cafe called Sarah's in Stuttgart. Usually when I accepted invitations, the host would ask me to speak on a specific African American writer or talk about my own work. The host from Sarah's had not specified what they had wanted me to talk about. I had never spoken at a cafe before. My talks had always been at high school, universities, and America houses. I arrived early and was given a tour of the huge facility that housed a library and a resource center upstairs. The organization had received government funding, my hostess told me. It was the biggest crowd I had encountered. They even had an interpreter. I was impressed. But something struck me as different from other talks I had given. Only women were present. I had been told that Sarah's was progressive. Obviously, I did not understand the connotation. They gave me a standing ovation at the end of my talk. I felt relieved. But then the question and answer of the talk arrived. They wanted to know why hadn't I talked about Audre Lorde or Tracy Chapman or Alice Walker. I apologized to them and explained that I hadn't been given a specific topic at all. Plus, Tracy Chapman was a musician, I wanted to tell them. Afterwards, they bought me too many drinks, and I did manage to get back to Tübingen on the last train. Back in Tübingen and all over Germany, thousands of students were marching in the streets, protesting the rising cost of college education. I agreed with the concept of protesting, but it was hard for me to have much empathy for the students. In the halls of the Breck Building, American Studies faculty, staff, and students were listening to their radios as more students took to the streets. I was surprised and delighted. I felt sure that W.E.B. Du Bois would have been too, since he had talked about how obedient Germans were. During that short period in history, Germans were neither obedient or orderly. Therefore, for those students, this was a serious act of defiance. In class, I offered my students an opportunity to talk about their issues, what brought about the protest, or we could continue with the scheduled text. They overwhelmingly opted to continue with the text. Some students asked to be excused to participate in the march. I approved. Students wanted to compare what they were doing to the civil rights movement. I thought this was a bit overreaching, but it was their fight. I wanted to tell them that during the civil rights movement, people were jailed, beaten, bombed, and lives were often lost. Instead of fear, bloodshed, jails, or death, the streets of Tübingen were energized. I didn't want to undermine their efforts, so I said little to them. The civil rights movement was too close to my heart. At every cafe, on every street corner, people were engaged in debate, and everyone knew what everyone else was talking about. Why aren't you marching? One student wanted to know. I am a guest of your government, and I will conduct myself accordingly. I thought the struggle for justice meant everyone, the same male student said. Hey, I have to know what I'm marching for, what I'm fighting for. When I offered you an opportunity to teach me more about your issues, you declined, and you think I should march? Would you march at home? Another student asked. I don't know. It depends on how strongly I felt about the issues. The classroom was silent again, trying to think of ways to further their argument with me. And remember, I continued, I am supporting you. I wanted to talk to you about your issues. and I'm aligned students out of time out of class. Those technical issues matters. What are other professors doing? I ask. Most don't even show up because they assume we're not going to be in class. The question then becomes, what do you do with the time? How do you make it valuable? This is your time in history, not mine, not your professor's. But what we don't have time is for this, another student whined. What do you have time for? I asked. This is your time to be counted and make a difference. But the question will be, what will your future narrative be? I was pleased to have students who wanted to live with the times and not roll over like their auras. Students who were willing to take a stand for change. Their motive was self-serving, but at least they were standing up. When I compared what they were doing to the civil rights movement, I concluded they had no idea how easy they had it. Hardly anything else was in the news other than the thousands of students who were marching in the streets every day. Bernd Engler and Horst Tahn, these are my professors in American Studies, and I talk about them together, like sort of Bonnie Clyde kind of thing, thought the marching would peak soon and lose momentum since a holiday was coming up before Christmas. Rosemarie, another friend I met, telephoned me often during those early days of the student protests to make sure I was okay. We had long discussions about politics, which she was well informed and passionate about. I learned a lot of German from Rosemarie, too, in that she spoke English, Italian, and French fluently. She understood languages, and since she had been a teacher for 30 years, she understood how to teach them. Just as it had been saved during World War II, Tübingen was saved again from the student strikes. Our students joined forces with the students in Stuttgart. During World War II, Tübingen was occupied by the French and had the hospitals and medical facilities. Every war needed medical facilities. I never felt afraid. I reassured everyone who called or sent emails. There was no incidents of violence during those days of protesting. Bernd Engler and Horst Tahn had no immediate opinion about the protest, at least not in my presence. They kept repeating this was bound to happen. The streets of Tübingen were nearly empty. I missed all of the activity. I caught up on my work and talked to my friend Rachel on the phone a lot. When I was an undergraduate student at Alabama A&M in Huntsville during the 1970s, most of the student body protested ROTC being a requirement, and we wanted African-American writers taught in the main curriculums of English and history. I agreed with both. Why was ROTC mandatory? Why didn't the administration care about the history and literature of Black Americans? I still have a hard time imagining how stupid it was for a Black college not to want to teach Black history and literature. Is this what self-hating ourselves was about? I marched. Surely we won. But I was a senior and wasn't there when the change was implemented. The only other time I considered marching was when I lived in Atlanta, Georgia in the late 1980s. Civil rights leader Hosea Williams led a march to Forsyth, Georgia, to protest that no Blacks had lived there. They had been run out more than 100 years ago. I don't remember the exact story, but of course it was motivated by race. Oprah Winfrey had even taped a show there. Marcus and I ended up not going. Maybe the march was called off, too many people were there already. But I do remember it was a cause worth marching for. In the meantime, I struggled through the German students' thought about when is it right to take a stand. The Germans seemed so privileged to me. Would they march for me? Probably not. Who would march for me? Who had marched for my rights? Is that the appropriate criteria to apply to justice and freedom? These were hard and honest questions for me as I struggled with who I was or who I wanted to be. Everyone was talking about the new millennium. Marlene, my Aussie friend, was sure we wouldn't survive all the hype. What would it mean to me, other than a marking of time? What would this time have to do with my life? What would it have to do with the life of my son? I couldn't figure out the transition of the new millennium in Germany. Expectations were greater than I was used to at home. I needed to ask Sylvia or Rosemarie, with all the type. I was beginning to wonder if Marlene hadn't been right. Could we survive it? When I was in the third grade, my teacher, Mrs. Taylor, told our class that the future belonged to us, and we would live to see the year 2000 if we took care of ourselves. But more important, we could make a difference and participate in this new world. Mrs. Taylor had surgery to have a goiter removed that year while we were on Christmas holiday. She died. No one explained to us what went wrong. I was sad for a long time. I thought of her often during those days in Germany, close to the new millennium. I never dreamed that I would be living in Germany. Mrs. Taylor would not have been surprised. I knew my life would be changed after the experience of living elsewhere. So, one of the things that I tried to do while I was in Germany, is to mirror some students, German students versus American students. So this is here at WVU, okay? One day after class, one of my best students stopped by my office. In class, we had just completed a discussion on the novels Quicksand and Passing by Nella Larsen of the Harlem Renaissance. What can I do for you? I always start off asking students that question. Professor Smith, I'm glad to be taking your class. You see, this is the only chance I've had to learn anything about being interracial. I was a little surprised since the student was the color of milk chocolate. She looked more like me than white. I see. My mother is white and my father is black. He left when I was a baby. It's so awful, Professor Smith. The student cried. Where are you from? I handed her a box of tissue. Wheeling was all that she was able to get out. I'm so sorry. My mother remarried a white man. Now I have a little brother. Everyone in my family is white except me, she said, continuing to cry. I see, nodding again for her to continue. What's really bad is that my three uncles are policemen. We eat Sunday dinners together as a family. All they do is nigger this and nigger that and always end in the world, always. The world would be so much better off without niggers. And then they turn to me and say, we don't mean you, Gloria. Do you know any of your father's relatives? No, not a one. When I've asked about them, I get the same answer. They ain't worth knowing. And I never heard from him. You're one of my best students. With only a year left, I think you should have started applying to graduate school. Where? On the East Coast or the West Coast? You're always talking about being a psychiatrist. Let's see if we can speed up the process. For real? Yes, I think we should start. Being a good student gives you choices. The process is tedious, but it's well worth the effort. What about money? I'm sure there are some fellowships for graduate school for excellent students like yourself. Thank you. You deserve so much better, I hugged my student. Later at home, I watched one of my favorite episodes of The Cosby Show. Denise decides she wants to be a teacher. Grampty, the family matriarch, and a retired school teacher visits the family from Virginia. In the last scene, when Mavis Staples sang, Have a Little Talk with Jesus, and he'll answer by and by, I prayed I had given my student the best advice. The only other time I had given advice to a student, personal advice, was when a white female student came into my office to tell me she had a thing for black men. Her baby's daddy was a black man, but he was in jail. She was trying to decide whether to tell him about the baby or not. I asked her why was he in jail, in prison, not jail. She said breaking and entering. She said she and her baby lived with her parents in Cheat Lake. I told her never to tell him. Okay. So, let's see if we can do that with my German students. After class, I went to my office. Someone knocked on my door. The knock was too soft to be that of Bernd Engler or Horst Tahn. Come in, Sie bitte, I called from my desk. Professor Smith, I don't mean to bother you, said a nice female student, with long, dark blonde hair and serious brown eyes. She was a student from the class I had just finished teaching. Her heavy book bag weighed down her petite body frame. "You aren't bothering me. Please sit down," I pointed to a chair. "I want to thank you for what you said in class." "You're welcome. Now, what exactly are you talking about? I say a lot in class." "You see, I'm Turkish." "I see," I nodded for the student to continue. "I don't think they know, since I look German. But you're so right. We are often treated, well, not well, by the Germans. I think they hate us. Well, not all of them, but too many of them do. My grandparents came here to work. I'm one of the only ones in my family to be able to go to the university." The student pushed back her hair from her face. "Do your classmates know you're Turkish?" I asked. "No. Well, I don't think so. My last name sounds German, and I speak the language better than they do since I had to learn it." "I see." "So I got to thinking, after reading the text I'm passing, that's probably what I was doing. Well, there are all kinds of reasons why people pass. In fact, we all do it on some level. Remember the Jesse Fawcett novel, Plum Bun? The mother passed out of convenience. She didn't otherwise value skin color, which is a different kind of passing than in Nella Larsen's novels. I'm very proud to be Turkish. It's just so difficult." "Of course you are. Think about it differently. Being difficult can be a gift." "Is that what you think about being African American?" the student asked. "On good days," I laughed. "My heritage is important to me. I wouldn't worry about it if I were you. What's important is that you know who you are," I said to the student. "Thank you. We're glad you're here. I'm glad to be here. I can also suggest some other texts for you. Thank you, Professor Smith. Thank you. You're a really good student." So I felt that those were good examples of how the situation mirrored itself and how race plays a difference, and it doesn't matter what color, where you are, it's always there. Okay, so this is a part that I'm going to read now. I think it's pretty, this is some friends who are visiting, and we're talking and carrying on, and these friends are from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. One of the things I did in Germany was to put together African-American women's lecture series, and I invited Trudia Harris, Carla Holloway, Joyce Pettis. So Joyce Pettis and Carla Holloway came together, so this is about that. "We got the last train back to Tübingen, which I had taken many times. Settling our seats, feeling like citizens of the world, my girlfriends and I couldn't have been happier. Can we really go to France tomorrow?" Carla offered. "Yes. But I need to tell you that Bernd Engler has plans. Tomorrow we'll spend the day with him and his family hiking, and then Lucy, his wife, will cook a feast for us." "That sounds marvelous," Joyce said. "They really treat guests well. I've never seen anything like it." "What are the students like?" Carla asked. "Interested, respectful, motivated, and really excited about your talks." "What about teaching evaluations?" Carla asked. "Well, they have them, but no one is required to submit them. In other words, they don't mean a thing." "That would be nice. How are students supposed to know if you're an effective teacher or not?" "If they're learning something," I said, and we all laughed. "It's not important. It's not important at home, unless they want it to be," Carla said. "What burns me up is, under the question, does this professor come to class on time? The answer is I'm always on time. I'm never late. If anything, I come to class early. The problem is, when students has to rate it excellent, good, or satisfactory, they mark good rather than excellent. Now what that's about?" "It's about," Carla said, "it's about racism. We can never be excellent. It's a category, save for others," Joyce said. "Plus, it's a stupid way to ask a question," I said. "That would never fly here. It's not like there's a lack of racism. I'm just not the focus." We were in a groove, laughing and comparing notes about our lives as African-American females, teaching at universities that members of our family would not have been able to attend 50 years ago. The train wasn't crowded since it was midnight and not a holiday. I was exhausted, but in the best way. Only seeing Tina Turner could have made our day in Zurich more glorious. Tina Turner is known to hang out at the train station in Zurich. A border patrol stood over me. I swear it was the same one who had harassed Marcus and me last Christmas. I could smell his sweat and tobacco. My anger about patrols had been building since Austria and last Christmas when Marcus and I were traveling back and forth from Switzerland. They were Nazis, but for me, they were the Klan, hosing down citizens with German shepherd dogs attacking them in Montgomery, Birmingham, Alabama. I reached for my passport. I handed it over without looking, signifying that he didn't matter. I felt some security in that I had a German work visa. He slowly gave it back to me. Both Carla and Joyce looked at their purses while holding their passports in hands. Then he took Carla's passport and held it up high, like he was having trouble reading it. She had traveled to South Africa recently. We were international scholars and artists, and our traveling proved it. The Border Patrol tapped his fingers on the back of Carla's seat. We didn't look at him. "What business do you have in this country?" the patrolman asked, like he owned the country. I spoke in my best German voice. "I am a guest of the German government. These important scholars are invited guests as well. Is there a problem?" I had not wanted to fight when Marcus was with me, but now I was with friends, and it was our fight. The damn patrol should have been grateful that such distinguished guest was interested in visiting the country which he did not own. Rested and assured, we spent the next day with the Anglers traveling to Freiburg. The mean Border Patrol had no room in a car as Bernd Engel led us toward our next experience. So I continue with them. So this is when they're leaving Germany. We drove Carla and Joyce to Stuttgart to the airport against the backdrop of a pearl gray sky. I felt like we were floating across the Autobahn. Sitting in the back seat with Joyce, I was already missing them. Their presence had given me strength I needed to complete my journey. We were unusually quiet. "Thanks for taking the boxes back. Just mail them to my office," I tried to be lighthearted. "That's a good idea, to give everyone something to take back," Joyce said. "My friends should participate in all of my international experience," I said. "Have you heard from many of your friends?" Joyce asked. "Those who want to come to Germany." "I heard that," Carla said. Her voice is soft-spoken but powerful. "Too bad many of my guests came before the warm weather. I needed coats and boots through April." "Now, if that was Miss Joyce, she'd just buy new clothes," Carla said. "Not with the German prices," I informed her. "That's very true. Everything here costs much more," Bernd Engler confirmed. "How do you manage?" "Well, of course, we earn more money than Americans. I could never work for such low wages," he said. We agreed. "Could you live in the States otherwise?" Carla said. "Not permanently. I would miss having a center of town. There is nothing more magnificent than having a center where everyone gathers." "I'm going to miss that the most." I wanted to cry. At the airport, I did cry. Everyone did, even Bernd Engler, a little. Although I didn't see his tears, I felt them. "What wonderful women," Bernd Engler said as we walked back to the car. "The best," I tried to smile. "Now, young lady, we've got to post your manuscript." I was happy to change the subject. 2. If we continued talking about Carla and Joyce, I would have wept. What were you saying about the manuscript?" I asked. "Talking about my work could get us all the way home, and I wouldn't have to keep crying about missing my friends. I just settled in and listened to the professor." "Yes, the manuscript." "I couldn't have done it without your help. Even that kind of talk was making me weepy. I had to get a hold of myself." "It's hard to do what you've done," Bernd Engler said. "And the support from the staff," I continued. "It was our pleasure, young lady." "Thank you again," I smiled. "It gets harder." Looking over his glasses, I saw the urgency in his serious blue eyes. "What, getting a book published?" "No, going back home. It's complicated to have been here for a year. I wished I could stay, but not really." "That's right," he said, "not really." I sat stone-faced. "And of course we'll miss you." I knew they would miss me. Everyone misses me. Their last two Fulbright scholars hadn't worked out well. One had been a too fussy male instructor from Duke or Vanderbilt who demanded an office with a printer. Contrary to Germany's power in the world, they were behind America in technology with regard to office products when I was there. Their computers were old and big and clunky and noisy. When I typed, whistles blew, which tickled the staff. They thought I was typing too fast. To print work, I emailed it to Tina, the staff person, and she printed it out and put it in your mailbox. Bernd Engler, the chair, was the only person who had a printer in his office. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. Tina's office was three doors from mine. Germans didn't often have answering machines in their homes. Most of the people I know have had some kind of answering device since the 1980s. The other Fulbrighter had been a woman who called them a bunch of crazy Nazis. She stopped teaching her classes. Sometimes she came to class dressed in a costume to see what they were saying about her, my students told me. Other times she shopped and traveled. The Fulbright Commission couldn't do a thing about her behavior. Rosemarie has invited me with her and her partner Manfred to Le Carno. I just love it, Ethel, Bernd says. You always have some place to go. If I didn't know any better, I think you would have lived here. You've lived here your whole life. He laughed for a long time, showing all of his teeth. You're in for a real treat. Have you ever been there? I asked. Yes, many times. It's one of Lucy's favorite spots. Remember, we have lived here a long time. When will you travel? Next weekend, after the manuscript is in the mail. I raise my hand with crossed fingers. That's good timing, young lady. By the way, you did a terrific job with the guest lectures, bringing in so many dynamic scholars and lovely women to us. Thank you for calling me young lady. I really enjoyed working on the lecture series. His driving wasn't bothering me anymore. Maybe I was getting used to it. So, it's a few days later. I still couldn't figure out why Sylvia was my German teacher. One of the things I did, I went over 6 weeks early to Kiel, which is up north near Denmark, to immerse myself in a six-week boot camp kind of class. Anyway, so when I got to Tübingen, where I was going to live, which was south, I couldn't understand a thing they were saying because they spoke very differently from the people up north. So then the university has this program called Tandem. So they would hook you up with a person who you would help with their English, and that person would help you with your German. And Sylvia and I became great friends. We're the same age. So I was expecting someone old and old school, like the people had been in Kiel. The people in Kiel were Russian, Polish, and didn't speak any English. So when I met Sylvia, it was just pure delight. She was young and wonderful and, you know, like me. I still couldn't figure out why Sylvia needed me for my English skills. Her English is excellent, and she speaks Italian and is learning Greek since they shared a summer house in Lefkas, Greece. Germans often own or have close ties to summer houses in Italy, Greece, Switzerland, the Riviera, and other exotic places. Sylvia and I talked a lot about our children, but our aging parents was a constant on our minds. Sylvia's father wasn't well, but most of all, we laughed. Everyone knew of our mutual admiration. One night, after midnight, I was listening to Johnny Hartman massaging me into sweet dreams. I often went to sleep with a silk in the voice of Johnny Hartman. When my telephone rang, my first thought was someone at home had mixed up the time, but it was Sylvia wanting to know if I would help her with a grant proposal. She apologized for waking me up. I told her that I would be happy to help her. We English professors in the States knew how to write grant proposals in our sleeps. After that telephone call, I started to dream in German. And the reoccurring dream I had about trains separating and I would end up in Siberia and couldn't speak German or Russian stopped. My dreams were always gray, never any color. Gray was the color of my new home. But I was beginning to feel good in my home. Langston Hughes had been right when he said, for black folks, no place is at home, therefore every place is home. I was dreaming at home in Germany. So, okay, there's just a little bit more. So Sylvia got the grant. She was applying for a grant proposal to work in the States, and she got it. So that's That weekend, after we found out that Sylvia had gotten the grant, Sylvia Kloss and I wanted to celebrate her success by seeing a film called Comedian Harmonious, which had won the Berlin Film Festival Prize. Set against the backdrop of 1930s Nazi Germany, the film is less about the Intrusion World War than it is about the music that defined the members of the Close Harmony singing group. The harmonists began to feel the weight of politics as some of their Jewish-oriented songs came under criticism. Then their sheltered world exploded altogether. I sat in the theater, stone-faced it, forgetting that Sylvia and Kloss were with me. For the first time, I had some idea what Germans had lost. Hitler had cost them heart and soul, their art. The loss was so great, they could never get it back. It didn't matter how many Audis, BMWs, or Mercedes they produced, or rapid trains systems they built. The art was gone, gone like the wind. The core of their being would never be again. No wonder Germans seemed so tortured, especially the men. Their loss had cut too deep. I had never heard music more beautiful and yet so sad than the soundtrack of Comedian Harmonious. In the States, the film is called The Harmonious. I have seen it at least 3 times since I left Germany. When Sylvia Kloss and I left the cinema, we went for coffee to talk about the film. "Wow," was all that I was able to say. "Wow is right," Kloss said. We are products of the 1960s and 70s, even though I graduated from college in 1974. It had been the 1960s that had made my success possible. "Do your parents talk about the war?" I asked. "No, not at all, Ethel. There is a silence in this country among our parents' generation," Kloss said. "But I thought Germans loved to debate. Not our parents, not that generation." "And not about the war," Kloss looked up. When he traveled in the States, he was often asked if he were an artist, since he was dark with long hair and a beard. There is a belief that if you don't talk about something, it didn't happen, and pretty soon it will become part of one's memory, and no one will know if it actually happened or not, Sylvia said. "When there is no memory, there is no existence," Kloss said. "Silence is very much part of the tradition of slavery, too. Total denial," I said. "How was the civil rights movement handled in your house?" Sylvia asked. "It wasn't. I read magazines when I could. I had one history teacher who talked about justice and equality all the time. When he was fired, I was devastated." "What happened to him?" Kloss asked. "I don't know. I didn't even know anyone who would know. I think about him sometimes," I said. "At least you had one person," Kloss said. "If I was watching Dr. King on television, my mother or grandmother would turn the television off and ask me, wasn't there some work I should be doing? I wanted to tell them that I was engaged in very important work, keeping up with what was happening in the world, but that would have been disrespectful." "Did you feel scared, Ethel?" Sylvia asked. "I'm always scared." "Even now?" "Yeah, sure." "What are you afraid of?" Claude asked. "Lots of things. Walking in parks, driving at night, going into stores to try on clothes, everyday kinds of things, swimming in public pools, public parks, you name it. When something has scared you all of your life, you don't become less afraid because there's a new law." "That makes perfect sense to me," Sylvia said. "Even libraries terrify me. And you have to remember the murder of Emmett Till and the 4 little girls who were killed in the bombing at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham were the cornerstones of my growing up years." "That's a lot." "I would be scared too," Sylvia said. "And all of those assassinations," I shook my head. "What else?" Kloss said. "That's not enough?" "Of course. I often feel cheated," I said. "How is that?" Kloss asked. "When I hear my white friends talk about going to the beach for holidays, knowing how to swim or playing in the woods, all without fear. In fact, they should feel entitled to have had such a childhood. My childhood should not have been rooted in fear. I would love to roam the woods, to be among nature. Instead, I learned to fear nature rather than appreciate it. Too many African-American children were found lynched in the woods. That's one of the reasons I like hiking here. I don't feel afraid. What about in big cities? Kloss asked. Less so. What else? Kloss asked. I think it's your turn. What happened in Germany affected all of us. And you're right. Seeing that film reminds me too much of what we lost, Sylvia said. And we can never get it back, Kloss said. By that time, we were the only people left in the cafe. We had traded our coffee for wine. There we sat from different worlds, but we were sharing a similar pain, the pain of history. Thank you very much.